Welcome to the I-29 Moo U Dairy Podcast. The I-29 Moo University is a consortium of the land-grant universities located in Minnesota, Iowa, South Dakota, and Nebraska. This podcast covers timely news, information, and research for today's dairy industry.
Welcome to the I-29 Moo U Podcast. I am Madison Kavarna, a beef nutrition field specialist based out of Watertown, South Dakota, with SDSU Extension. I'm pleased to share that Dr. Blake Voracker, hopefully I'm saying that right, he'll correct me in a second if I didn't, but he is joining me, and I will give him a few minutes to tell us more about himself. But Blake is an assistant professor in meat science at Texas Tech University. He recently was the star on a Dairy Beef Dialogue webinar, also hosted by I-29 Moo University, where he shared valuable insight into the carcass yield of beef on dairy cattle. I'm excited to dive further into this topic with him, not only for my personal curiosities, but also for you, our listeners. So first, I do want to give you a few moments to introduce yourself to our listeners, like what do you do for work, where are you from, and how did you find yourself in the meat science world, or I suppose I could say cooler to be more meat science terminology friendly.
Yeah, well, thank you, Madison, for having me on the podcast. It was a pleasure to give the webinar and group with the I-29 Dairy Beef Series does a great job disseminating information, and so appreciate the work that y'all do. So a little bit about me, you're pretty close on the last name. So
Darn it, I was hoping I nailed it on the first go.
it's German, it's 4 acre. A lot of people try to make it something it's not. But anyway, I'm an assistant professor in meat science at Texas Tech. And so what that pretty much means as a meat scientist is that my expertise is in the conversion of the live animal into its meat products. And the nice thing about that kind of discipline is we touch a lot of different aspects of animal science. And obviously, you know, that's been important to beef on dairy here, you know, in the last 5 to 7 years, is that population of cattle has become more common in our industry, just kind of understanding their live performance and then how the carcasses perform, obviously a terminal progeny, so very, very important. So found myself as a meat scientist through 4-H activities growing up, did meat judging in high school for a couple of years. That led to time at Kansas State University doing my undergraduate in animal science, where I was on multiple different judging teams, and then had some great internship opportunities with Cargill at the time in Fort Morgan, Colorado, and at their corporate office in Wichita. And so it was through those experiences that then I decided to pursue a master's degree in meat science at Colorado State University under Dr. Dale Warner. While I was there, I also coached the meat judging team. And then Dr. Warner took a new position at Texas Tech in late 2018. And about that time I was graduating with my master's, and I decided that I wanted to pursue a PhD because that was going to be required to sustain a position in academia. And so I followed Dr. Warner to Texas Tech, got a PhD in meat science at this program, graduated in 22, and took my first faculty role at Washington State University. So a long ways from home, being, you know, in near Wichita, Kansas. And so that was a really great experience to get to know a different part of the country and kind of establish a program on my own. And then was there 2 years and then just got hired back at Texas Tech last fall. So in a position that pertains to teaching and research. So the teaching component of my job primarily pertains to coaching and mentoring the judging program. So I coach the meat judging team at Tech, in addition to the meat animal evaluation team. And then my research would pertain to all aspects of carcass yield, meat quality, and then, you know, some statistics that we kind of throw in around the periphery of the many of those topics. So
kind of all over the place, a lot of experience to share. I dabbled a little bit in meats judging. I did not go on the South Dakota state team, but I did do the class and dove into some meat science topics and even spent some time working in the meat lab. So hopefully my little meat nerd can come out a little bit and I can maybe keep up with some of the topics. But definitely to pave the way for some of us who maybe don't have as much of a meat science background. I kind of want to bring them up to speed on a little bit about what we're going to chat about. Of we're going to mainly focus on influences and just kind of all things carcass yield of these beef on dairy cattle. But first, to kind of simplify it, what are some variables that go into carcass yield, or even better yet, what even does carcass yield mean for anybody who is less familiar?
Yeah, I think that's a great place to start, Madison. And so obviously, we're going to be talking about a dairy influenced population here with the beef on dairy calf. And so obviously, dairy influence being a set of breeds that have not been primarily selected for their meat characteristics, their yield characteristics over time. Obviously, the intent of those dairy breeds was milk production, right? And so kind of anything outside of that became secondary. And so that's where we run into historically perhaps some deficiencies, especially with the straight bred dairy animal from a terminal aspect. And one of those deficiencies was and is carcass yield. And so let's add some parameters and some definitions around that. Maybe firstly, most importantly for the listeners, is what carcass yield is not. And so what I'm not going to be talking about today is dressing percentage. I think a lot of guys, particularly at the feed yard level, would talk about yield in the sense of dressing percentage. And so that, or in other words, the relationship of the carcass weight to the live weight. What I'm going to be talking about today pertaining to carcass yield is, in fact, the consist or the composition of the carcass itself. So, independent of the relationship of that carcass weight to the live weight, what, as we break that carcass down, what percentage of that carcass is comprised of edible tissue? So, remove away the bone. Remove away the fat or most of the fat, leave a small level of external fatness on some cuts, and a very important component is the trimmings as well that we're removing from the carcass in that process. But ultimately, we get down to the high value red tissue, or what we've termed in our industry as red meat yield, and that is the subprimal portion, which then further food service sectors, distributors, retailers are fabricating into retail cuts. And so when I say carcass yield, what I'm meaning is the percentage or the consist of the carcass comprised of edible tissue.
Kind of going further off of that conversation, one thing that I can see potentially a lot of people who are just maybe less familiar with what we talk about in the meat science world, and we bring in carcass yield, and another thing that they may be more familiar with is that yield grade component, or if you sell cattle on the grid, that's a lot of the times you'll see a bonus related to yield grade and how that goes. And especially our feedlot producers are going to be more familiar with that as they market cattle. And in your thoughts and experiences in the meat science world, how have yield grades trends been shifting? I mean, we all know we're finishing cattle bigger and heavier than ever before, including bringing in some new ideas with these beef on dairy cattle. Is that making the already elusive yield grade two or those lean, heavy muscled animals harder to achieve? Or kind of in your opinion, what are you seeing kind of on that front as well?
Right. So let's start a little bit about defining yield grade. That is the grading system that was designed to predict the percentage of boneless, closely trimmed retail cuts from a carcass. And specifically, that percentage was expressed just from the round loin rib and chuck. So, in fact, didn't include the thin meats, if you will, of the plate and the flank. And so that's what that equation grade was designed to predict. It was developed actually in the late 50s, early 60s, and then adopted and implemented by USDA in 1965. And so it's a grading system that's been around for some time. It was developed by Mr. Charlie Murphy at Texas A&M University on a sample of 162 head of cattle, which at the time had more than half of those 162 head had a hog carcass weight less than 600 pounds. And so we start talking about yield grade and its its value or its inaccuracy in today's industry, it becomes really relevant to understand why it's perhaps no longer relevant in our modern cattle population. And so, particularly in the application by which it was designed. So, in other words, using the same four traits that were designated in 1960 as the traits to go into yield grade and using the same coefficients, we've got some problems with that grade today as it pertains to our larger, fatter, heavier cattle. And so that we certainly know that it's inaccurate. In fact, some of our data here at Texas Tech, as we relate yield grade to the pounds of product that the packer is able to sell at the back end of the plant. Now, that's not retail cuts, that's subprimal yield, but we would make a relatively large assumption that there's a relationship between the pounds of subprimals and the pounds of retail cuts because, the retail cuts are being generated from those subprimals. But if we relate yield grade to the percentage of subprimals at the back end of a packing plant, that relationship is quite low. In fact, anywhere from 20 to 40%, pending the data set. So 20 to 40% of the variability explained, I should say, in that data. So yield grade's not doing a great job in the modern cattle. And there's some reasons for that. One is certainly the weight parameters and the fact that cattle are so much heavier today. And that specifically has to do with the relationship of that weight to another component that goes into the yield grading system, which is ribeye area. So if you're not familiar, two of the four factors that go into the yield grade equation are hot carcass weight and ribeye area. And the reason why they were originally designated to go into that grading system that such that as cattle got heavier, carcasses got heavier, they required a larger ribeye area in order to have no change to their yield grade. And basically, as cattle got bigger, if they didn't maintain a consequent increase in ribeye area, they got penalized in the yield grade equation such that their yield grade would go up. And if they had a larger ribeye area as they got heavier, their yield grade would go down and become more favorable. And so that's just one example of two factors. As cattle have gotten bigger, we've actually found that that relationship, Dr. Ty Lawrence at WT has done a great job of demonstrating this now for a decade or more, that relationship is not linear as it's presumed in the USDA equation. In other words, the biological relationship is not linear. And so actually, as cattle get heavier, ribeye area starts to wane off or starts to plateau. And that makes biological sense because the accretion of muscle at those heavy weights starts to slow down as we start to increase fat at an increasing rate. Fat thickness is another component that goes into the yield grade. It's perhaps the most discerning one or the one that contributes the greatest to variability in the percentage of cuts that we're able to generate from a carcass. And that's a fat thickness that's obtained between the 12th and 13th ribs, opposite the ribeye muscle. And then the final fat thickness is still a relatively good measure of fatness in cattle and a decent measure of percent total yield. Again, still need to be able to account for differences in the distribution of fat beyond just that one location. And that's where we get some discrepancy and error in that measure. The final and fourth metric that goes into the yield grade equation, perhaps one of the metrics that at least in our current industry, that's created a major challenge with how the USDA yield grade was designed, is the measure of kidney, pelvic, and heart fat. And so this is a metric that at the time of the 1960s was included into the equation as a visual estimation of kidney, pelvic, and heart fat or KPH fat. And so basically, you would have a greater look at the internal fat depots within a carcass and say that it looks like there's approximately X number of softballs, and one softball equates to 1 pound of fat. And I'm going to express, the number of softballs on a percentage basis of the carcass weight. And so they might come up with a number of 2.5% of the carcass is comprised of kidney, pelvic, and heart fat. Well, in today's cattle, That number on average, according to our data and many others, is that on average, native beef cattle are somewhere between 3.5 to 4.5%, and dairy cross cattle would be closer to 4.5 or 5% of their carcass weight being comprised of internal fat. So it's a little bit outdated relative to the equation that was developed in the 60s relative to the mean KPH percentage prevalent in cattle. One of the other challenges with that is in most packing plants in the US, not all, but many of them, they're removing KPH fat before the grader has the chance to assess the carcass for that metric. And in fact, it's being removed after the hot carcass weight is obtained, but on the harvest floor, because that hot fat is much easier to trim at that point in time before it has time to harden and solidify. And so, in fact, we're not actually, because that KPH fat is not staying in the carcass, less than 25% of beef carcasses in our US industry are actually assigned an official USDA yield grade. Most of the yield grades that feed yard operators would be viewing on a closeout sheet are actually internally or house-derived plant yield grades by that company. And one of the reasons for that is because the USDA grader is not being allowed to assess that KPH fat at the time of grading.
It's interesting to me too of when you start to think of how plants have started to become more efficient over the years of just being in operation. And I mean, they're not playing a game by how many carcasses can I get in a day. It's an hour, it's a minute type efficiency we're talking about. And if I've seen the KPH fat and it is a bear to cut out once it has time to sit in the cooler and harden versus when it's that nice, soft, slippery fat straight from the kill floor before we've put it into the cooler. And one other thing that was kind of sticking to my brain a little bit when we were talking about yield grade is the fact that ribeye area does play a large role into by the textbook equation for yield grade. And with that, I think it's always important to remind producers too that with ribeye area, there is almost a consumer ceiling, one might say, of what a consumer deems acceptable. Might be a bit of a dramatic and strong word to use, but when we start to, if I were to go anywhere in South Dakota, I know that for sure, and I were to ask someone if they wanted a ribeye that filled their plate, the answer would more than likely be astounding. Yes, absolutely. I would love to have that much beef. But when we start to go to those white tablecloth restaurants, it's just not feasible to offer. And those steaks, the bigger they get, the heavier they are, for the thinner they are. So it's just kind of a into the consumer preference too. So it's, kind of a nice thing that they start to top out on that size too. And one thing that came to my mind, and it kind of feeds into this question of you already mentioned that dairy breeds are inherently just lighter muscled than our beef breeds just because of how they were selected. And as we bring more of these beef and dairy crosses into the feedlot sector, what do you see kind of being an impact on those carcass characteristics or see happening there? I know that might bring some of these dairy beef animals in, might inherently maybe shrink that ribeye area just a little bit. But I was just kind of curious what you thought of what that dairy influence might do for our carcass characteristics in the plant.
Firstly, I think that what's important to recognize is that the beef on dairy cross animal has replaced the straight bred dairy animal. And so there's no question about it that from a carcass characteristic standpoint, these animals are far superior to their Holstein counterparts. I always like to lead with that because I think all too often in our industry, the first thing we want to penalize the dairy cross for is that, well, they're not the native beef animal. And in some respects, they're not, but we would have data to show that in many, they're just as good, if not better, and if managed properly. And that's kind of the asterisk on that. So if we just kind of start at the front end of the production chain, at least at the packing level, if you're just measuring a metric like dressing percentage, you're going to find that dairy crosses are a half to 1% generally lower than a native beef animal. So if native beef is at a 64.5, you can expect dairy cross steers to be at a 63.5 pretty commonly. Okay. Now, one of the major challenges and disadvantages that I don't think is news to anybody with a dairy cross is the higher prevalence of liver abscesses relative to the native beef animal. And so that is a substantial concern and of substantial cost and a worthy discount of this cattle type if they're not managed in a meaningful way to try to mitigate that challenge. We see incidences of liver abscesses up to 60 or 70% of the lot that has some form of this condition. And it becomes particularly bad when those cattle have to be railed out because the liver abscess is so severe that it's adhered to the diaphragm and other portions of the carcass. And we perhaps have to condemn an entire gut pile, which can be upwards of $180. We can result in severe trimming of the most valuable cut of the carcass on a per pound basis. That's the outside skirt muscle or the diaphragm muscle when we have adherence there. And then perhaps one of the most costly reasons for a liver abscess at the packing level is the cost of downtime. And so anytime that we have to stack up a number of these beef on dairy crosses that have had some of these severe liver abscesses, we have to stack those up on a rail out chain and stop the chain in order to process those carcasses. The time required to stop that chain is operating at about $1,000 a minute. And so things start to add up pretty quickly, and that's the biggest deterrent or disadvantage from a carcass characteristic standpoint of this cattle type. As we move further into the plant, well, actually, we've already talked about KPH, and so we know that somewhat inherently, even on an equivalent carcass weight basis to native beef cattle, we're going to have a slightly higher percentage KPH fat in dairy influenced cattle, whether those be the straight bred Holsteins or the dairy crosses. As we get past chilling and we go towards carcass grading, these beef on dairy crosses do quite well. And so from a quality grade standpoint, we can expect a very high percentage of upper two-thirds choice and prime carcasses from this particular cattle type. And there's many reasons for that. One is genetics, two is days on feed, three is because they're a little bit lighter muscle, it's easier for them to deposit marbling on a percentage basis into those ribeyes. From a yield grade perspective standpoint, at least using the traditional yield grade metrics, generally they're fairly desirable. But again, I wouldn't put a ton of stock into that metric and what's its meaning at the packing plant level. And then, very few studies have actually conducted an in-plant yield test to compare cattle types. And so that was one of the projects that went into my dissertation work, oh, I guess, 3, 4 years ago. And so in that study, we compared just that native beef cattle, beef on dairy crosses, and dairy cattle for their cutout value at the back end of the plant. So we quite literally took 220 carcasses. We fabricated every one of those at a commercial packing facility, and we weighed every single component that came off of those carcasses. What I think it's important for the listeners to understand is in that particular study, and we selected the carcasses based on the average fat thickness and the average carcass weight for that cattle type. And so that meant that the native beef cattle were fatter on average than were the beef on dairy crosses, which were fatter then than still the Holsteins. And so that's about a 6/10 to a 4/500 to a 3/10 spread between those three cattle types in that order that I listed there. Which is really no surprise. I mean, on average, we took millions of data points to come up with those average back fat thicknesses. We did the same for carcass weight because we wanted to make sure that we were slaughtering cattle and evaluating cattle that represented the average for their breed type within that study. And so actually what we found is that there was very little difference in carcass yield between the average beef on dairy cross animal and the native beef animal, and both were far superior to the straight bred Holstein. And in fact, there was a great deal of variance between beef on dairy cattle. So even though their average subprimal cutout value, or the value of all of those, the red meat tissues that come from the carcass, even though the value of those tissues from beef on dairy crosses wasn't all that different between native beef animals, there was a large spread within that group. We had some high yielding dairy crosses and some low yielding dairy crosses. In fact, a spread that was meaningful enough that spread between high yielding and low yielding dairy crosses was just as wide as the spread between the native beef animal and the straight bred Holstein. And so that told us that it was really important that producers paid attention to carcass yield within this cattle type population. And that's something that, as we talk about, what traits do producers need to be focusing on if they're, considering breeding their dairy cows to beef, or if they're looking at retaining ownership in those calves in a market where, beef is at an all-time high. Carcass yield is a paramount metric that they should be looking at, particularly in terminal sire selection. And so, and what I mean by that is trying to find sires that will optimize carcass muscularity much more so than just ribeye area. And so, because we know that that's frankly not a good metric of improving overall carcass yield. So, looking at things like hindquarter muscling, in fact, we found that the one trait that mattered the most in differentiating those high and low yielding dairy crosses, one trait that mattered the most was the muscle to bone ratio of the round. And so that, I think, provides pretty telling evidence to producers that just kind of old school livestock judging principles, get behind them and butt cut them, kind of the message and takeaway from that work, at least in terms of maximizing value from, again, this somewhat muscling deficient population. But I think fat thickness is another important thing that producers can't forget. As we fast forward 3, 4 years from that work, all too often I see hens of dairy crosses that are entirely too fat. And if you're feeding them fatter than 6/10, on average, at the 12th rib, you're feeding any yield advantage or quality that they might have to native beef animal, you're feeding it out of them because they're too fat. And so inherently, we know that this cattle type is going to have a little bit more bone that they're going to have to overcome with some added muscle. If you're just layering on additional fat on top of it, that's not going to help matters.
You nailed it right on the head. At least one of the things that stood out to me is you talked about how the variance between your top end of your beef dairy cross cattle versus your low end on that yield perspective was just as big as if we had just, beef versus a full blood dairy. And I think, we get I know on the fully beef side and talking with a lot on the feed yard side of things, these beef on dairy cross calves that come out of the dairies and off of the calf ranches, people like them because they're so uniform. It's almost like they're the same critter across the pen, depending on where you're getting them from. If you're getting them all from the same person, the same, dairy, the consistency is just remarkable in my eyes. And to kind of see that the difference between, like you mentioned, the genetics and all of the things that go up to getting them into a feed yard really can start to cause some variance just among it. It's an interesting thought when you start to think about how different they are from each other in this new-ish, one might say, industry of these beef dairy crosses. But we're getting close to the end of our time together, which definitely bums me out because I feel like we're just starting to get to the stuff that's really starting to make my little nerd brain fire rapid fire. But to kind of close us out, you talked a little bit about it, and if I'm dreaming this up a little bit and that you've already discussed it, feel free to let me know. But could you talked a little bit about cutout value differences, but we mostly kind of focused on carcass yield in that last conversation. But could you explain more about those cutout value differences between those beef dairy and those dairy beef cross cattle and what that may mean to our industry folks out there in terms of cutout value?
In our industry, we use the cutout value. That'd be a number reported by USDA on a daily basis. So through the mandatory price reporting, packers have to convey the weights and the prices of all of the different cuts that are sold at the back end of the packing plant. And from that, we're able to compute a cutout value, which is different than the carcass value. Basically, looking at those things allows us to understand the profitability measures within the beef industry. But there's no doubt about it that what the packer is able to sell the carcass for is going to drive their purchasing decisions upstream and buying fat cattle, which then ultimately drives signals in the market upstream from that at the feeder cattle level and beyond. And so that's why cutout value is an important metric within our industry. And so, and that the biggest way to change that cutout value is to change carcass yield. And so, because we know that cutout value ends up being the weight of all of these components times the value of each of those respective components. And so, anytime that we can increase the weight portion of that multiplication equation, then we're going to inherently increase the total overall cutout value. And so, again, you know, to no surprise, the high yielding beef on dairy crosses and the native beef cattle had the highest percent carcass yield, and so therefore they also had the highest cutout value and were the most profitable within that particular study. I'd like to just throw in one additional thing here as we move toward, you know, this model and understanding beef on dairy crosses and their carcass yield characteristics got us thinking a lot more progressively about how do we provide objective tools to producers in the industry to not just make dairy cross cattle better, but to make all cattle better. And so we've got some really interesting red meat yield, carcass yield research going on here at Texas Tech that I think many of the listeners will become more aware of moving here into the future as we start to unveil some of these technologies, things like CT scanning carcasses for a more accurate measure of yield that provides a non-invasive type measure of carcass composition that wouldn't require us to go into these packing plants and require and measure every single component that comes off a carcass. Looking at things like 3D imaging, whether that be through a LiDAR camera or using different radar technologies to basically equate live animal or carcass morphology, the shape and features of those animals or carcasses, equating those shapes to carcass composition and yield, and, you know, things that we've been doing as livestock producers and livestock breeders for centuries, but with our own eye. And so providing some more objective tools to do that is really exciting to me as we move into this new era of yield.
And I remember from your webinar presentation, if anybody wants to go back, you had some pictures of the CT scanning carcasses, and I thought that was just, you know, you never think about it, but to see it actually, you know, in that one standstill picture, it's interesting the amount of information and data that, you know, we think we've got how to finish cattle figured out, but I feel like there's so many more hidden things that we can be better at and improve ourselves. And if it means doing a whole bunch more cool work to look at the, you know, inner workings of these carcasses, I just think it's really cool as an industry where we're heading with folks like you doing this meat science research for folks like me that are out here getting feeding information out to our producers. But I unfortunately will have to cut our conversation here. I'll give you another little tidbit of time if you wanted to kind of send us out with, you know, a closing statement or just a kind of that thought-provoking end, and then I can close us out of here and we can hopefully let some people think on all the things that we've shared today. But do you have any of those kind of take-home messages or things to think about after they get done listening to this episode that you'd like to share?
Sure. I guess a thought-provoking question, maybe to some listeners, is at what point does the dairy cow start being selected for meat production in addition to milk production? That's kind of a neat thought-provoking question. But no, I mean, in all seriousness, I think those producers that are choosing to contribute to the beef on dairy cross, which I believe is many dairies nowadays, I think they're doing an outstanding job. You talked about the consistency. I think the product that they're producing today is much better than it was, you know, 3, 4, 5 years ago. And so they're to be commended for that. But I think, you know, there's huge opportunity for this population moving forward as we head back into a rebounding cattle cycle. There's no doubt that when packers can get choosy, they will. And so make sure that your cattle aren't at any level of deficiency to give a packer reason to discount them if you're to, you know, want to continue to remain profitable in this business. And so I think one of the leading, you know, opportunities there is liver abscesses, but then I would characterize red meat yield as secondary to that. So lots of exciting stuff moving forward, but I think all in all, We all know that these dairy crosses are here to stay. Continue making them as good as we possibly can.
Dr. Foraker, I really want to thank you for joining us today. And this conversation has allowed me to bring back a little bit of that meat nerd brain from college that I talked about and kind of get back into that train of thought. And the meat science world is so interesting and is super important for our producers and industry folks to understand, as our cattle will find their way to the meat sector at some point in their life, whether that's when they're in that 18-month range or some of our cows that may go back in. So it's just an important end game that we need to remind ourselves that every animal will find their way to the meat sector if possible. And I hope our listeners will take advantage of the information you have shared with us and utilize it in their operations and their daily life. I want to thank you again for taking the time out of your afternoon to record this with me, and for the listeners who are tuned in listening to this final product that we've put out. Like I said earlier, our episode's coming to a close here, but this has been I-29 Moo You Podcast. And I'm your host, Madison Kamarna from SDSU Extension. Until next time.
We'd like to thank our annual sponsors, including our gold sponsor, Iowa Corn Growers Association. Please visit their website at iowacorn.org. We'd also like to thank our silver sponsors, Pioneer, Connor AgriService, Diamond V, and Central Vet Clinic. I-29 Moo University is an equal opportunity educator. For the full discrimination statement, visit extension.iastate.edu/diversity/EXT.